Support for business and economic development reporting comes from Pitts Construction, your full circle building solution. Learn more at PUETZCorp.com.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Everyone has their own stories of adversity. Not everyone is willing to share them. James Kelly asks business leaders and innovators to share their stories on his podcast, Executives After Hours. After dozens of conversations, he noticed themes of authentic leadership emerging. So he wrote a book, The Crucible's Gift, Five Lessons from Authentic Leaders. I spoke with James Kelly yesterday about caring more about who people are than what they do, the path to self-awareness, and developing a growth mindset. I want to begin before the book with your podcast, because it's a podcast with a slightly different slant to it in the fact that you're trying to figure out who people are instead of just what they do. Tell me a little bit about that podcast and how you got started and how you pivoted on that journey to sort of develop what it was going to be.
Yeah, so I really appreciate that question. So at the end of the day, the podcast tagline is, I care about who you are, not what you do, because who you are defines what you do. And so I just found that the origination of the podcast was really a completely different space. I had started, and the original name was Brave Endurance Wellness Podcast, and I was really interested in corporate wellness. And so I thought, why not learn about it by interviewing CEOs and executives in that space? And about episode number 50, I just started noticing this pattern. And two things really occurred. One is I got less interested in corporate wellness and more interested in people's stories. And the pattern was adversity, challenge, success. And in that, there were different components. And so at episode 70, I pivoted away from Brave Endurance, and I just basically migrated to Executives After Hours. And so my content's always been autobiographical, because for me, that's always been the most interesting thing, as we are all on our own journeys. And I just thought, man, these people have really interesting lives. You can learn from their mistakes and their successes all at the same time.
Hmm. I've always called that me search, where you're doing research, but secretly you're just trying to find out stuff that or you're doing research and you're picking out parts of that research that I call me search, and the fact that I could apply it to my life. So,
yeah. Oh, that's absolutely correct. Yeah. Absolute me search, 100%.
Do you find that there is a sense of generosity to the people who share their stories with you on the podcast and then eventually in the book, in the sense that they're willing to be seen as a whole person?
So that question to me is something I had a feeling and belief about up till about probably a month and a half ago. And okay. I'll explain. Yes, I think people enjoy telling their stories. We all have unique stories that should be told in their own voices. And you do this for a living, you know this. And when people are given the opportunities to tell their stories, if you are good at listening, you're listening with intent, you're able to actually ask the right questions to move them along their story to get the best nuggets of information. Mm-hmm. So that is where it started. And I do believe that wholeheartedly, but I also believe that many of the people I interviewed were also trying to self-promote, which makes lots of sense. Mm-hmm. And so in that, once the transaction was done, where I thought there was a deeper sense of connection, perhaps there was not, if that makes sense.
Right. How did you need to get past that? Did you need to just accept that that's part of the transactional relationship of interviewing somebody?
Yeah, I think that I had to, you know, we're all on our own personal, I'd like to think, personal development journeys. And this is something for me where when I'm willing to share something with you and you're willing to share something with me, yeah. I believe there should be a connection there. And I think there genuinely is.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. Like I've had to transition to say, I'll make this as meaningful and impactful and as personal as possible, because for me, I enjoy that process. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I had to kind of just tick the box, so to speak, and move on.
Right. Because then, you know, I mean, it's you and I talking, but really it's this, you know, these listeners that we can't see right now and might not meet who are part of that transaction as well. So when you interview people for the podcast and when you put a book into the world, do you have a sense of a reader, a listener, or do you just say, I need to write what's in my head, I need to write what needs to come out on the page, and maybe there's an audience for this, maybe there's not, but that's not my concern. Which camp do you sort of fall in when it comes to a listener or a reader?
Yeah. I think, you know, my background is that I have a PhD in marketing.
Okay.
And
yeah.
so the irony is that I should be thinking of the customer first, right? That's kind of the philosophy of marketing, is deliver or create what the customer wants. There's also another camp that kind of says create it and they will come if it's good enough. And so I tend to fall into the create it. And so when I wrote the book, or even with the podcast, because my curiosity is just so deep about trying to understand human nature and human beings, that I'm more curious for myself. And in turn, I think I allow the audience to kind of go on the journey with me in the podcast.
Yeah.
And that resulted in the book, and I hope, at least, taking my readers on a journey through the process.
Let's talk about the book a little bit, The Crucible's Gift, because from a structural standpoint, did that structure sort of come to you naturally?
Yeah, so let me tell you how I wrote the book, and the inspiration came from really two places. So I wrote the book last summer in Portugal. And so my family and I were vacationing there for 6 weeks. We had a beautiful condo on the beach, and I would go to the coffee shop every day and write, and they would be at the beach having fun. So so I spent the summer, but what was great about it is the way that I did it. And so this is going to answer your question 100%, is that I created an outline in question format. And each chapter had an outline, and my wife would interview me. And because she doesn't know the topic, we would record the interviews, and she would ask me follow-up questions. Well, what do you mean about this, and can you explain that? And so what would happen is that we would record it. I would transcribe it that night, and the next morning I would have 10 pages in my inbox. And then I would take that and wordsmith it, and then back into it some research. I would read some books during the week. So I was doing all sorts of research during the week while I was writing this. So it was organic inside me. It's something that I've probably been sitting with for 20 or 30 years. And it was supported by the interviews that I conducted for my podcast and the research that was out there at the same time. So it was more like affirmation by external resources.
That's a fascinating process for writing a book.
It works for me. I get total paralysis when I type. Like I have to like stop, rewrite. Like to do a one-page blog takes me like 4 hours. It's ridiculous, actually. So.
And yet you're pretty good, blogger as well. I was reading something about the Velveteen Rabbit. I was like, I need to. It's one of a great book, and I suppose a lot of people have strong memories of the Velveteen Rabbit, but so do I. And where did that sort of that imagery come to you as something that people needed to hear about?
I love that question. So thank you. That actually came to me in a point in my life where I was going through a crucible.
Yeah.
And the timing of this interview was fantastic, because I'm going to present on this tonight at a bookstore.
Yeah.
Is that I actually made a mistake in my early 20s, and I got a DUI. And part of my DUI was an outpatient program. And the counselor in that outpatient program made all of us read that the last day that we were in the program, that section that I put in the book. And so for me, it was very much about learning that you're loved regardless of what you perceive to be your negative attributes, and that it's okay to have them and embrace them and use them to actually be a more whole person. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that aspect really came from. I didn't read that until I was in my 20s, but it had such a profound impact on shifting my thinking about who I am and my expectations of others around me.
Yeah. So you understand narrative structure of an interview, and you understand that we've kind of jumped in the middle here. So let's go back and for our listeners who are like, why aren't we talking about what a crucible is? Let's cover some of that. And how do you define crucible in the context of this book? You've given us one example. Give us a broader picture of what that is.
Sure. So the way I define it is, it's any significant moment, event in your life that fundamentally forces you to reflect and shift your core identity. And we all have them to some degree. The biggest thing that's important about the crucible is really what comes after that, and that's the ability to self-reflect. And I think that there's another misconception in that, is that people seem to think or believe that if a crucible, the next day there's going to be self-reflection, and that is not what I found, and that is not reality. Most people have crucibles. It may be 6, 12, some people I interviewed, it was 10 years down the road before that particular crucible that happened 10 years prior impacted them in that moment.
Are you seeing that there is something that would cause that? Is it unfinished business? And then therefore, it comes up eventually, say, maybe it's the death of, you know, of someone that you love and you don't really get to process that grief and then it comes up later? Or do you think that, you know, as something new is happening in your life, that you somehow subconsciously or consciously access that crucible that happened mm-hmm. to you in, you know, in your 20s, and all of a sudden it makes sense to you?
I think both.
Okay.
And I think that each person's crucible is so individualistic and personal to them that to say that there's a generalization is false. So I've had some
sure.
that were a culmination of 5-10 years. I've had some that I thought I had reflected on that kind of came up out of nowhere in another circumstance or moment. And this happened with many people I interviewed. Let me give you one example. There was a guy who's not actually in the book, but we were talking about his crucible, and he almost died falling off a mountain. And so as he falls off the mountain, for the next 5 years, he lives his life the same, abrasive, direct, just 100%. And then his cat dies 5 years later. And he is in tears, bawling. He didn't cry at all when he almost died, by the way. But his cat dies. In that event, he was forced to think about the event when he almost passed away. And that ended up being a 5-year leg in reflecting on his personal crucible. And it was some random event. I mean, the cat is personal. I'm not trying to downgrade that. But that event triggered the event that happened prior to him almost dying.
Wow. And where did he get that self-awareness that those two, you know, responses or that emotional response to the death of his cat was somehow related to this near-death experience that he had? Was that through a therapy? Was he writing about things? Did he just take a walk and, you know, sort of came to him that these things were connected, right? My question is, how do we access that self-awareness post-crucible?
So I think there's a couple different ways that this can occur. And again, I can't be clear that every person's journey is different.
Right.
And that everyone has to figure out, first and foremost, you have to be willing to look at it. You know, my mom's generation, my mom's in her 70s, she's not good at looking at adversity.
Right.
She's good at packing it inside of her and sitting on it, but she's not so good of actually thinking about it. And so there are generational issues. But this particular individual, for him, it was just him trying to figure out, why is he crying so hard about the cat?
Right.
And that's when he started kind of pulling on the string to figure it out. You know, for me, it took the DUI I got. It took getting married. You know, and by the way, adversity can be positive. You know, getting married, having children, taking a new job. You know, often we think of adversity as a negative thing, but it can be just the opposite. It can be positive. We just don't focus on that as much. But to answer your question, you know, every person, you can do journaling exercises, you can do meditation. You know, one guy I interviewed who wrote the foreword of the book, named Joe Burton, he was a very successful business person by 40 and working for a $1 billion company as COO. And he quit his job based on a multitude of moments of adversity, and he found mindfulness. And in that, he found clarity of how his adversity actually made him a better person, not a worse person.
Right.
And so, you know, you have to, as an individual, be willing to inspect something negative. And it's not easy. I would never claim for it to be easy, but you have to be willing to ask the question, what is good about this situation, not what is bad about this situation? There's a lot of research that talks about when you frame the question in a way that you're looking for the best in something, psychologically, neurologically, it has actually a much bigger impact on your attitude and behavior moving forward. But we're conditioned to look at deficits, what's wrong, what's broken, what's not working. And in doing that, that's actually kind of creating a barrier and a wall for you actually growing as an individual. Because usually when you're looking for what's wrong in a deficit state, you're actually then creating guilt and shame for yourself. So looking for what's best in something, I mean, I'll use my dad's death as an example. My dad died when I was 20 years old, and it took me going through my DUI to actually have reflection on that. But I started looking at what was best about his death. And things that I found was I learned to live a healthier life. I learned to value relationships differently. I learned to control my anger better. Yeah. You know, these are all things that I could have said, well, I'm fat or I have a bad anger issue, or you know what I mean? But instead,
right.
I can look at the best of these things and what I could be by looking at his death.
So, and not to minimize suffering or to, you know, kind of say, well, this is an opportunity for something good to come out of it. But can you generally, and by that I mean, you know, your friend comes to you and says they have a cancer diagnosis, the first thing out of your mouth is not going to be, you could probably find something good in this. But as if we have our own self-awareness, then we can, in some ways, you know, inoculate ourselves by preparing ourselves for the next crucible that we don't know what that's going to be through developing some self-awareness about everything that comes your way, you know, it might have potential for growth if you approach it right.
Well, and I think the word you just used there, and this is something I found, because there were plenty of leaders I talked to who didn't really understand their adversity.
Okay.
There were people that I would talk to that would share their story and then ask me not to publish the podcast. And based on the spectrum of stories that I had, their story was really nothing. But for them, it was significant, and they were embarrassed and had shame about it. And so the word that you just used there that's so important is having a growth mindset. And that's, I create a framework in the book, and one of the bookend of it all is the growth mindset. And what I found is that leaders and individuals, and this book is beyond leadership, by the way. I know it's in that category traditionally, but it's really about how to think about adversity overall. Sure. And those that embrace the growth mindset really do an outstanding job of actually over time really reflecting on the positives of that adversity moment. You can't ignore the negatives. Like, they're there, right? I'm not saying turn a blind eye to them. What I'm saying is that you have to embrace them and be in pain for a while and be uncomfortable for a while. And only in that moment of pain does actually clarity of independence of thought really occur.
James Kelly's book is called The Crucible's Gift, 5 Lessons from Authentic Leaders. We'll have more with him later in the hour. Now let's get back to our conversation with James Kelly. His podcast is called Executives After Hours. His book, The Crucible's Gift, 5 Lessons from Authentic Leaders. He's on a book tour now with his children along for the journey. We talked about what's next for the author. Has going through this process of writing the book then changed how you do your interviews? Are you pivoting again and thinking about, you know, what's next?
Yes. Yeah. So this is actually something I've really been pondering for probably about 6 months. So I had an executive coach, and I had indicated to her that now that the book's written, I feel like I answered a lot of my questions. And so I'm trying to figure out what I want to do next with the podcast. And that's something that I'm trying to decide on now. I'm going to go back. I'm taking a break now for the first time in 3 years. So
yeah.
I published for 3 years consistently, and I'm now on break, though I'm still publishing random stuff throughout the break. But I'm going to go back to interviewing in September. And I think what I'm going to do is, because it's such, you know this, it's such a competitive space, podcasting now, and pretty much anyone can have one, and every person who has clout has one. And so you have to figure out how you can be a bit different and unique. And so what I'm doing is, starting in the fall, I'm actually going to produce series, and the series will be 10 episodes, and these 10 episodes will be by city. So it would be Executive After Hours Dubai.
Right.
And I would interview CEOs and executives by city, with the last episode getting all of them together to sit down and do a roundtable, like half of them at least. And so the idea is to kind of tackle growth and challenges by city, by CEO, versus just around the world. Just kind of personalize it a bit more.
And do you anticipate, you know, and it's hard to say, answer this question now, but that you would find sort of geographic themes? I'm thinking of, now I can't remember the title of the book that talks about sort of like, you know, places where genius sort of bubbles up, and it's certain communities at certain times. Do you anticipate that in different cities you would find these vastly different, you know, cultures and corporate cultures and personal cultures that would be applicable to other places?
Wow. So I think I'm open to the possibility of that being the case. But what I have found, you know, I've been fortunate enough to live in Australia as an adult, in Japan. I live in the Middle East right now, and I've lived in 4 major cities in the U.S. And what I have found, you know, in the Middle East, I'm in a melting pot of people from around the world. And what I have found is that we actually are way more alike than different.
Really?
But because I talked about earlier about the deficit approach, it's so much easier for us to look at what's wrong or different than it is what's right and similar. And so my guess is that I will find more similarities around characteristics and people's journeys, mm-hmm. which kind of adds to my theme I've been saying my whole life, is that everyone puts their pants on the same way. So,
yeah,
you know, yeah. So, I mean, that's a great question. I don't know. My guess is that I'm going to find similarities more than differences.
Right. But as a researcher, you're open to, that's the methodology that you use, is more of an openness to sort of see those themes emerge. You're not trying to prove or disprove something going in with the research.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that's, I'd like to think that was my method for this book, though. That being said, like I said, I had these ideas in my head for a long time,
right.
And I just found the evidence as I did the interviews and started looking at the research. So I don't, maybe I think every researcher tries not to be biased.
Yeah.
But I think your own personal bias gets in the way.
Sure.
You know, of the process.
Yeah. So. And let's talk a little bit about the structure of The Crucible's Gift, in the sense that you address things like self-awareness, as we mentioned, and integrity and compassion and relatableness and curiosity. And it all kind of feeds into this notion of authenticity. And I'm wondering if you could just touch on the idea of, as you mentioned, some people not wanting to share their story even after they had shared it. So they wanted to share it, but they didn't want it to be public. How much of ourselves do we bring to work? Do we bring to the public sphere? And how much do we keep private? It's not as easy to decide those things as it used to be, yeah?
Well, I would argue that it's actually easier, but we still want to delineate the two. If you just think mm-hmm. about the construct of social media is inevitably transparency, or at least fake positioning of transparency, depending on who you are as the person.
True.
And so often I talk about in the book having a public versus private self, in that many of us go to work and we put on a certain hat and we act a certain way to impress certain people. And then at home we take off that hat and we act a different way. And the argument that I make is that we work for roughly 84,000 hours of our lives. If that doesn't depress you enough, I'm not sure what will. And so why would you want to have two different identities that run in parallels? It's exhausting. And so my argument is that if you can find a way to move that public and private self closer together, it actually relaxes you. It gives you a sense of confidence and faith in your ability. And people can see through it. I'm sure that you have, and I know I have, worked with individuals who really had to fake it till you make it. And they would act like they had all the answers, and they would act like they were, you know, that they were large in charge. And the reality is that you saw right through it, and you lost mm-hmm. respect for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so often in a business society or even relationships in general, because of the basic fear of being judged, we put on a different hat, and we want to try to manage that judgment. And so what I always argue is that you want to stay within 15% of your authentic self. Now, for some of us, we don't know what that means. You know, and I always would say to someone that if you're trying to figure out what that means, go get help.
Hmm.
Go seek out. There's, you know, we live in this world sometimes where asking for help is seen as a weakness, and I couldn't disagree with that more. I think it's a total strength to say, I don't have this, but I want to understand this, whatever this is for you. And asking for help allows you to say, okay, I recognize that I have something I need to get better at, so how do I get better at that? Right? How do I find my strength in who I am and use that strength to align my public and private self to live a more authentic life? I would never claim that it's easy, but what I have found is that the individuals who really embraced their crucible and understood where their strengths were and the best of in those moments were really the ones who became more authentic in their lifestyle choices,
mm-hmm.
who really understood that relationships matter most. And it's not even just me saying that. Literature is very, very clear from an academic standpoint that the power of relationships in an organization gives people purpose and meaning of why to show up and how to work. So, for example, just the average engagement rate in the workforce in the U.S., according to the Gallup organization, is roughly 33%. So imagine if you're a manager or a CEO. That means that roughly 67% of your employees don't actually engage fully in their job. They show up and they participate. Participation is being there and doing it. But engagement is part of the conversation, part of the process. And so just imagine if some people don't do that, the impact that it has.
Right.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah. Right. And let's talk for a minute about your kids, because as you talk about sort of staying true to who you are in your personal and public life,
yeah.
you're on tour and
yeah.
you've got the little ones in tow. That must keep you grounded and keep things, feeling like a full self instead of separating, you know, your road life from your home life.
You know, it's funny. I've asked my two oldest, who are 10 and 8, if they want to come see me do an event. And they always just say no. So I try to ask them, I want them to be part of the process. But yeah, the short answer is, and I think at a very young age, whether it was context, environment, inside me, I'm not really sure. I always had the ability to kind of just be me, you know? And there are times when that doesn't necessarily show itself, I'm sure over time, through teenage years, high school years, things like that. But I always tried to be myself. And I recognize that's not as easy for everyone. But with my kids, I really try to emphasize being the best version of you as you can be.
That's James Kelly. His podcast is Executives After Hours. His book is called The Crucible's Gift, 5 Lessons from Authentic Leaders. It is available now.